We're talking local today, and very, very local. This is the theme that has been emerging over the last few months, during lockdown a little bit, communities getting lots of focus of attention and ideas about new ways of working within the charity sector to get money to organisations on the ground. And we've got quite an interesting guest today, and also we have a very interesting person who's been involved in receiving funds, which are very locally focused. Camilla, why do you think it's sort of suddenly becoming the theme post-lockdown that this is the way that charities have got to go?
I think it's partly because we've all become more local. We've had to stay at home.
Yeah.
We've had to get to know our area. And when you look around your place, maybe you see the great things about it, and maybe you see the things that aren't so great about it.
Keith, what about you?
I think what we found is some people are very vulnerable now because they're only staying local. And other members of the community have actually, you know, stepped up to the mark. They've started delivering. They've started just checking people are okay. So this whole local bit at the moment, I think, has really grown. And we're in a situation where, you know, build local, build better. You know, all the rest of it is about how we can invest in local areas.
And Alex, is this going to become something which is almost like a policy, which is a way forward for lots of people? National government's going to have a look at it and think, right, yeah, let's focus on it.
Well, certainly Danny Kruger was very supportive of it in the report that he wrote to government at the back end of 2020. I think there's something about that local nous, that local knowledge that sits within communities that perhaps it's difficult to extract for at a national level. So there's that bottom-up approach that has been really, really effective.
I like that idea, the local nous. It's knowing what's needed, isn't it, really? It's sort of getting money to the places where it can actually have a real impact. But, of course, that has problems along the way as well, which I'm sure we're going to be delving into.
It is about what does a local area need, not necessarily what they want. It's what they need to make sure they add value to that localism agenda, if that's what it is nowadays.
We should do the big reveal. Our guest today is Matt Leach, who is the chief exec of Local Trust, an organisation that has been responsible for funding 150 neighbourhoods across England, each with a commitment to £1 million each from the big local, the National Lottery Community Fund-backed programme. But we'll give more details of that. Camilla, any other thoughts before we start to welcome in our guest?
Just the idea that I always pushed when I was a local activist, if that's the word. We are the experts in our neighbourhood, and that's what gives us strength in any kind of process like this. So one of the problems for anybody coming from outside is how do you use that expertise, and yet how do you make sure that it's not just a few people in the community with a bit of power who are going to throw their weight about, make sure they become important, and the community can kind of follow on. And that's always a problem for communities.
Camilla, you were one of my trustees. I know you're an activist. But there's a lot of things that we're going to try and unpack today, David. I think that is about, it's £1 million. It's a lot of money for some local areas. How are they monitoring that? How are they ensuring that the outcomes are what the actual areas need, and it's not just the whim of a few good-hearted, good-minded local people?
Great. This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. Matt Leach is the chief executive of Local Trust. Since 2012, Local Trust have been delivering Big Local. That's the National Lottery Community Fund-backed programme, which has committed £1 million to each of 150 neighbourhoods across England. The largest single-purpose lottery-funded endowment ever made, and the biggest ever investment by a non-state funder in place-based, resident-led change. Matt, have I got all that right? It's slightly complicated.
I don't need to introduce myself, do I? you've got it all there. The programme really had two big ideas behind it. First of all, there were some places in the country that had missed out on their fair share of funding. So often they were places that had quite high levels of deprivation, but seemed to not be getting the same level of grant funding from the big lottery fund as was, perhaps hadn't been successful in accessing regeneration funds. But I think the other part of the big idea was the reason they hadn't succeeded in getting that funding was because they were places where perhaps civic institutions weren't as quite well developed. People weren't organised. There weren't the micro community groups and charities that might have been applying for that money or advocating on behalf of their areas. So when big local money came, the idea was that it would be provided in a way which helped communities develop that infrastructure. So it wasn't just money to give away in grants. It was money which was provided in a way which would incentivize and enable the development of local community level leaders and organizations around. And local trust acts on the one hand as the bank. So when a partnership want to spend money, they ask for it and we send it to them. But we also provide support and assistance on a light touch basis. There's quite a lot of networking that we support between different big locals to learn from one another. And we help broker access to resources and ideas from outside of their areas. So all of the big local areas that we're working with now are 2/3 of the way through a 15-year journey. And increasingly what we're seeing across the country is communities setting up community institutions which might support them over the long run. If you went to Bristol, you'd see the Lawrence Western big local setting up a solar farm and a wind turbine to provide income to support community facilities, becoming a landlord, building community-owned housing, negotiating with the local authority over land use decisions over big tracts of land in their area. So you can see a real progression happening.
When you got involved initially, what was it that really excited you about this way of doing things?
David, you know, if you were offered the opportunity to take on the leadership of an organisation whose sole purpose was to give away over £1 million to each of 150 groups of local people and help them to achieve the most they could with that, you probably wouldn't say no, would you? It's the most amazing thing that you could possibly choose to take on as a challenge. But I think for me, the really powerful thing is seeing this process by which you take communities who often have been defined by others as perpetual applicants, supplicants, complainants, put in a position where actually they can make decisions, where they have the power, where people have to come and negotiate with them. And I think the money's really important, but what's also important is that change in power dynamic.
Keith?
A lot of application forms are really horrendous. Have you got a simple application form for releasing the money to these areas?
When it comes to making decisions about the money, within a community, we ask a group of local people, we call it a partnership in our jargon, to come together to self-nominate, to take responsibility for leading the programme. And the expectation is that they come up with a plan for the area, which sets up priorities, the things they want to spend their money on. And we expect them to consult with local people on those priorities. We accept that sometimes people will, you know, take baby steps before they take big risks. You know, sometimes people will make mistakes, mm-hmm. or indeed sometimes communities will fall out with one another and argue before they decide what they want to do. But the great thing about Big Local is that it runs for 15 years. We can work with the time frames that communities need to make decisions. If you think about regeneration programs when they come from government, too often the idea is you must spend within 3 years or 5 years,
yep.
or you've failed.
Yep.
Our starting point is that communities need to make decisions on timeframes that work for them, and they need to do it in ways which help them to build confidence and to build skills and to build relationships themselves. We're not there to do it for them. We'll help.
Brilliant. Camilla, you've got experience of kind of working with local communities. Your question.
I guess my big question, Matt, is what does success look like? Mm. So you're 2/3 of the way through. You're sustaining communities, but what happens at the end of the 15 years?
If you kind of talk about, you know, what we want to achieve in the long term, what we'd like to see is that at the end of the program, there are more people in those places who are capable of advocating for their communities, of self-organizing, and proving that by providing actually relatively small amounts of money, £1 million sounds a lot of money. It's enough to bring people together, but it's not a huge amount of money when you consider on an annual basis. We're talking about, you know, £70,000 a year over 15 years. And I think one thing that we've seen, we did some work with the All Party Parliamentary Group on Left Behind Neighbourhoods, looking at the experience of communities during the first months of the COVID crisis. We measured the density of mutual aid self-help in communities across the country, and we found that there was 60% less mutual aid activity in communities which lacked places to meet, had low levels of pre-existing civic activity. And those same places were also receiving 60 or 70% less in the way of emergency funding, aid from philanthropic, from grant-giving institutions. And I think what we can say about big local areas is that we've had communities of people who've been able to stand up and take action, self-organise, address issues of loneliness or food provision, and take action often, you know, if we look back to March or April, before the state was able to roll out. So I think there's a real question around what are the tools and techniques we use to rebuild effective civil society and civic life in places where, for whatever reason, it's disappeared or it's downgraded because the community centres aren't in use anymore, because the pubs have shut down. Mm-hmm. How do we get that going again? And I think for us, part of our success criteria is, will we have provided sufficient evidence and insight over the course of our 15 years? We're spending a lot of money on evaluation and research to help people understand those interventions that can make a difference.
Alex Scales is with us from the Centre for Charity Effectiveness. This must make it really interesting from a sort of almost like a study academic point of view, Alex.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess being two-thirds of the way through, Matt, my question is, you know, how much of a seat at the table does the organisation currently have at government level in terms of, you know, talking about the role of communities in levelling up, very popular phrase at the moment, and now around rebuilding post-COVID?
There's a genuine interest within the political process in questions of building the strength of community. We saw Danny Kruger's report back in September, which included within its recommendations a recommendation for a Levelling Up Communities Fund, very much based on the Community Wealth Fund idea, which Local Trust has been working with others to promote. Essentially an idea that you might take the next wave of dormant assets and put them towards a very long-term endowment to support rebuilding civic infrastructure, social infrastructure in left-behind areas. I think at a practical level, it's more challenging in government because I think if you look at, for example, the recent announcement around a levelling up fund, actually there isn't any real engagement with the need to reinvest in building that kind of micro level social infrastructure. On one level, that's really quite disappointing because levelling up and rebuilding and rebalancing our economic and social sphere is about more than just sorting roundabouts and bypasses and hoping for some economic trickle down. I guess if I was going to pull out the biggest bit of learning, Alex, from what we've done, is that if you're going to work with local people to help them rebuild their communities, it's a process that can take years and requires a very long-term commitment, not a three-year treasury fund, but rather maybe a 15 or a 20-year investment in supporting people to rebuild institutions that sometimes existed and were strong, but perhaps have slowly withered or disappeared over many years.
Matt, we'll just pause for a second. In a sort of bit of a first, we've got somebody who has been the recipient of a large chunk of money via your organisation, and that's Elthorn Pride. We have Sandy Phillips, who's the chair of Elthorn Pride, with us. Elthorn Pride covers an area in Islington. So tell me about how it all started. How did you come across this potential fund of money, and how did you get yourself organised to apply for it?
Right, so this sort of came about on the back of the Olympics from about 2012. There was a newspaper article calling out to sort of local residents wanted to get involved in the big local. And, you know, it was something that I was really enthused about. Having worked in local communities, one of the things that I often hear is, you know, oh, here we go again. There's another organisation telling us what's good for us. So there's a lot of disillusion from people. Yeah. So the first thing we had to do was giving some money to sort of put together a business plan, which was accepted by local trusts in terms of helping us spend this particular funding. And, you know, what was great, we sort of set out between us and our local residents to think about particular themes that would be of interest. So supporting young people, supporting the elderly, enterprise and employment, as well as the environment. So all our programmes centred around those particular themes.
How important, Sandy, was it having somebody at the beginning who was paid to support you? My personal experience is that volunteers, everybody's keen, But then when you start assigning tasks, people don't realize they have to do something in order to get the thing going. So you had paid support.
Right. We had paid support in as much as developing of the business plan, but the rest of it was down to us. At the time, I have to say that our rep was absolutely fantastic because he had a knowledge of the area and...
That's key.
Yeah. And somebody who was prepared to actually listen to some of the issues that we had, because to be quite honest, I mean, on the surface, it sounds great. Here's £1 million, go spend. And, you know, speaking to some individuals, it's like, well, yeah, where's the catch?
Yeah, where's my money?
That's right. And then we had to make the distinction between ourselves and the local council to say, well, this money isn't to mend your broken windows or whatever. So, you know, there was that particular dialogue. I think for us, we were quite fortunate that we had a mix of people from different backgrounds who were able to bring different skills to the pot. I'm not going to say it was easy. I mean, at the the early years were really fraught with power struggles,
disputes,
all of the above.
Yes.
Yeah. And some of us, you know, we sort of persevered, put personalities aside. I think that was the most important thing. And just think, you know, what is the vision that we want for our community?
Good for you.
I guess that's welcome to the community then, isn't it, with that? But what two things have you delivered that you're really proud of at the moment with this money?
We have a lot of issues in our community with gangs and so forth. So some years back, right, we worked closely with a couple of organisations to do a small film, short film, based around gangs and knives.
And the film itself is really an amazing piece of work. It's called Don't Get Drawn Out, created by children on the Elphinstone. I think we're going to hear a bit of a clip from the film now.
Hey, you man better find Jacob by tomorrow. I'm going to come for you, yeah? I'm going to come for you, rude boy, and you, big man. I'm going to come for you, savage. Yeah, you better find him. Man, better find him.
It must have a huge effect on the pride of people in the estate when something like that film is, you had a premiere at the Regent Street Cinema. It featured a couple of quite well-known actors, Ashley Walters and Purcell Ascot, as well as lots of local people as well. It must have had an extraordinary sort of galvanising effect on kind of young people.
Definitely. I mean, it became a phenomenal, that over 1 million views on YouTube, and it built up to 3 million. And we were able to, on the back of that, create more opportunities for young people wanting to do short films, because there was a follow-up. We created a really good relationship with a lot of the stars in that as well. So long after Elphorn Pride ceases, you know, in the context of big local, there'll be ongoing activities that individuals can get involved in. And I think that's really important as well in terms of setting the groundwork for what's to come.
I'm guessing that your area has been particularly affected by COVID. You have a major London hospital, which has been really one of the epicentres for intensive care during COVID, on your doorstep. That's the Whittington Hospital. Emotionally, how important has it been to have that sense of community properly looking after each other in a really, really difficult time?
Listen, I can't underestimate it. I mean, the way the community came together last year, it was just so epic. I mean, we sent out a call to action. That was the first thing we did. The minute we got information that there was going to be a lockdown, I actually spent a little time just putting information out there. But I think what was most important was to not frighten residents, but to let them know that, you know, we're here to help.
Yeah.
It's been a difficult year, sort of fraught with up and down, you know.
Have you had people in the community who've lost relatives?
Yeah, definitely, because at the beginning there was a situation where a number of residents were shielding, not just elderly, but lots of young people were shielding, with families who were shielding because they had vulnerable children. So people sort of reached out to us at different times. We had a couple of families who had no recourse to public funds, so they just had no food. And it's like, please, could just somebody just bring something to us or help us? So we were able to help people in real time, which was quite important. There wasn't that lag.
But I mean, on a practical level, you set up online cooking tutorials. You become Nigella Lawson.
That's actually quite funny. There was a lady called Mama G. She has a pop-up right in the middle of our big local area. So she knows families, youngsters go there after school. And she's doing a series of tutorials based on the foods that people are telling her that they like, and most importantly, affordability. And it's really fantastic to have somebody that's actually worked locally and knows the residents and is able to do some of those lessons as well.
It looks like chickpea, coconut and potato curry is the top rated dish.
I should say I've tried all of them. Don't necessarily come out the way they look, but, you know, I've given each of them a try. Yeah.
Sandy, do you want to talk a little bit about the future? Do you want to tell us where you see Elthorn Pride going in the next few years as this money continues to be rolled out?
The journey from last year to this year, very, very different, because now it's not the unknown, it's more of the known. And people are suffering mental health issues. People are finding it difficult because they have lost not just one, but multiple loved ones. People have lost jobs, and, you know, trying to sort of create that sense of community, it's needed more than ever. And, you know, people are, because they know us, they're able to reach out to us and we're able to support them. We're forever having conversations around what will Elthorn Pride look like in the future. We've already had a decision that it will be a charity. We'll definitely do some of the same work that we're doing, but there'll be offshoots within that. I mean, the key thing that we're doing now, as I said, is laying a foundation. So having a resident-led organisation that is empowered to actually make a difference in their community is a fantastic thing.
So, Matt, we've heard the experience of Sandy there running Elthorn Pride, an extraordinary rebirth of a sense of a community, it feels like. Is that the sort of story you hear from around the country?
I think what we see in all the communities we work in is that there are brilliant people, and people who, if you give them the time and the trust and the resources to make a difference, they can make great stuff happen. I think what's really important about Big Local, though, is actually what works for Sandy in Elthorn is very different from what might work for a community in Dissington, just south of Workington. It's a housing estate right on the northwest coast, so they have a whole lot of issues around being quite remote, finding it hard to access services. They bought some land in the middle of their estate, and they're looking to put 44 homes for older people there. So as people get older, they can stay in the community rather than having to move several hours away to a place where they can live and get health care and social care and support. Now, buying land for 44 homes in Dissington in Workington cost them £85,000. If you tried to buy land for 44 homes anywhere near Elthorn, you'd be talking about tens of millions of pounds. So different communities will prioritise different things. They'll have to use their ingenuity and their skill to lever the most out of it.
Alex?
I was really interested, what's your experience in terms of leveraging additional funding into the areas where local trusts are situated?
We don't require big local areas to lever in money. Some big locals have focused very much on just using their money to mobilise local people. Some others, I mentioned Lawrence Weston in Bristol, have levered in millions of pounds on top of the big local money they've spent. It was interesting, talking to Mark, the worker there, a few months ago. He was talking about going to the bank to seek some finance to support his energy scheme. And he said initially he walked into the bank and they looked at him like this scruffy bloke off an estate trying to ask for some cash. When he then said, well, I'm part of the big local and we've got, you know, £700,000 still in the bank, he said they literally changed the quality of biscuits in front of him, you know, and different people came into the room. So there is something important about giving people agency.
Inevitably, though, Matt, there is, at the back of people's mind, there's always something, but hang on, does it work all the time? And there is a bit of a but, and I'm going to hand over to Keith on the but question.
What I believe I'm hearing is that a lot of communities want to build back. You said play schemes, community centres, leisure centres. At the end of your funding, are you not in a danger that all those are going to go back because they used to be funded by local authorities that have stopped funding? So all you've done is, you know, extend those challenges that they're going to face.
On the one hand, a lot of the communities we're working in didn't necessarily have that luxury to start with. They've had to build and rebuild.
Yeah.
And we know that a lot of the communities that don't have strong local leaders and local charities and community groups find it hard to lever in resource in the first place. I mean, there is money, not as much as it was out there, but it tends to be the affluent, the articulate, and the already organised who get access to it because they know how to get it, whereas the communities that are most left behind tend to not get a bite of that at all. And one thing we do find in big local areas is that often they're able to deliver amazing social outcomes at a fraction of the cost of the sorts of programmes that, local government tends to want to roll out to address the same issues. So you also lever the power of local ingenuity and their ability to design things that work well for a local place.
If things have gone wrong, how do you then learn from the progress? How do you go in, help, advise and say, look, maybe we should look at this again. Maybe we should, there's a different way of doing it.
We have a model which involves very light touch support. We have community development professionals who might, you know, maybe one day a month go in and check out how things are going. Perhaps if there are issues or disagreements, facilitate conversations, perhaps in help people with decision making or to get through difficult points of conflict. And overwhelmingly, that works. Right at the heart of our ethos and the way we try to do things is believing that if we trust communities and work with them, then, you know, in most cases, we'll get the best possible outcome. And if we compromise that, you know, there's always a danger with programs like this that you worry so much about the occasional risk that you ironclad yourself with forms and bureaucracy to protect against it. And that creates a whole lot more waste and damage and loss of resource than the occasional thing going wrong.
Camilla?
What worries me is not the risk and it's not the failure. It's the lack of ambition. So I've seen far too many community initiatives where it's like, do you want a hanging basket? And they go, well, sure, who doesn't want a hanging basket? But really what you're trying to do is empower communities to use their imagination to go to a place they hadn't already thought about. Now, how do you as an organization empower people to think beyond their own boundaries?
I recognize entirely what you're saying. And I think that process of moving from simply doing what people say they want to helping facilitate a conversation about what people need and what communities need is part of that, that process. And I, you know, I remember very early in my time at Local Trust going to a big local area and them showing me a children's playground and saying, well, this is one of our early investments, and looking slightly sad about it. And I said, well, what is it about this that you feel a bit equivocal about? And they said, well, we built it because people said they wanted it. And it was only afterwards we realized that the only reason in the consultation people said they wanted a children's playground was because that was all they could conceive of. They'd only ever been asked by the council whether or not they wanted a children's playground.
Yeah.
So that was what they wanted. But now we realize we've got to do more. And I think the fact that our program lasts for 15 years makes a real difference. It's a long-term program that allows for growth and it enables people to move from, you know, making a few micro grants, doing some mid-scale projects, to sometimes doing some quite big stuff. I think at the same time, we try to provide people with access to ideas and ambition and inspiration. Mm. Increasingly, a lot of what we do is bring together 20 big locals who are interested in a particular theme. So I think we have 26 big local communities interested in local action on climate change, and we bring them all together and they spur and inspire one another on.
Matt, it's been fantastic to hear from you. This is the first podcast which has come with a fantastic recipe idea courtesy of Marley's Kitchen in North London in Islington. The chickpea, coconut and potato curry as recommended by Sandy. Matt and Sandy, it's been fantastic to hear from both of you. We wish you well in the future.
David, thanks very much. And Keith, Alex, Kimberell as well.
Matt Leach, the Chief Executive of Local Trust. Keith, Camilla, Alex, points and observations from that?
It seems to me the big local picks up where the local authority has stopped.
Absolutely.
And so from, say, 2008, when we had the last crisis, all I heard as a trustee was, this is the next thing they're going to cut. And the things they're going to cut are all the sort of things that Matt and Sandy were talking about. Yep. Giving, reinstating. And so I have a bit of a, haven't we been here before, feeling about it all. I feel like it's an overall good thing, good values, good intentions. Some will be hugely successful, some will carry on, some won't. I don't see that it's an answer to economic revival, bringing back cities, pubs coming into the locale and being vibrant again. We need much more fundamental change.
But surely local authorities have always got a cap on the amount of money that they can give out and they can focus on communities. And in a way, they are being empowered to know how to get the best out of those councils, to lobby them in a way that they can become almost the lobby group towards the local authority, aren't they?
Yeah, but that's very much about understanding civic duty. Civic duty isn't just about going out and volunteering for something. It's understanding how the system works to the advantage of your community so that when there's a big development in the area, local residents don't just go yes or no. They involve themselves with the process and they say, where's the community infrastructure levy? That's all fundamental to really proper change for a community.
Keith.
David, I think, you know, I fall back on my local government experience. And actually, one thing I would like to add time to a question with Matt today was when he said about, oh, local groups taking on these things, leisure centres, libraries, to run. The way that it's happened in the past is because it was cheaper than the local authority doing it. They weren't going to pay the same wages. They didn't have to pay this, that or the other. And one of the concerns I have is that, you know, I'm with Camilla on this one. You know, I think all we're doing is putting off stopping everything again if we're not careful. I am all for a pub that has a childcare arrangement and Meals on Wheels. But it's a difficult thing to maintain going forward. And if that money isn't coming in, even if it's for 10 years, it's great. But if it doesn't come in, I'm not sure how it's going to be sustainable.
But isn't there a sense, I mean, this comes back to Alex, the learning that is going on and the way that it's feeding back into policy and it's changing potentially the whole system. And Alex, you know, I could hear you getting excited at the notion that this is all feeding into this big box of thinking around this.
I do get quite excited about this, I have to say. And, you know, I was really pleased to hear Matt talk about evaluation. You know, they had learnt themselves from the start of the project that, you know, their evaluations need to be used much more to generate insight and learning and not to test what they were setting out to do in the first place. Because actually, you know, I think if everyone is very honest, we haven't got a flipping clue how to solve these issues, because if we did, we would have solved them ages, you know, ages ago. I can see where, Camilla, you're questioning the ambition, but that, you know, it really is baby steps, as Matt said, for some of these communities in terms of how do you empower and build confidence and trust.
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a way of learning, but it's a bloody expensive way of learning if you're pumping £270 million in it.
But if you break it down, you know, £1 million over 15 years, and you've emboldened people like Sandy and undoubtedly the group of people that she has around her to be ambassadors of a community and setting up things in their local area that will help. And yes, of course, you know, the recipes online is a minor thing that could be done in a different way. But surely you are changing a belief system about people living in 150 areas around the country.
It's a good demonstration, though, of how it's so important to measure value on money invested. There's social value that is created by that, which isn't necessarily immediately apparent. And there was that lovely, you know, I think you used it, David, about galvanizing pride around those million hits that the YouTube video had. And if that just reaches two or three youngsters in that area who then decide to do something else that will be enhancing their life, then I think that's got huge attributable value that goes alongside it.
Sounds like we should roll the credits, don't you think?
Yeah, go for it.
GoodCharityBadCharity.com. That's where you find previous episodes. Find us on Twitter at GCBC Podcast. Dan Hardoon of Whistledown Productions is our producer. The Centre for Charity Effectiveness are our guiding light, and the City Bridge Trust are helping to underpin the whole thing. From us all, Good Charity, Bad Charity. Till the next time, goodbye.